He's an all-around gentleman and a first son of the state of Texas. Everyone put your hands together and please say hello to Daniel Miller. Daniel, it's been far too long, my friend. How are you?
It has been, but, you know, here's the thing. The fact that you and I haven't spoken in years means that you just introduced me like I'm a wrestler, and I'm okay with that.
You are a wrestler. Now, my personal bias might come through here because as a show of appreciation back in 2012 or 13, we went to an event in, gosh, I'm trying to remember if it was your event or not. It was in Houston. I brought my daughter, who was then 13 or 14 at the time, and you awarded me a Bonnie Blue Texas Independence flag, the blue field with the white star, and some kind of an acknowledgement from the TNM. You know that flag is still hanging up in my garage?
That's great. That's great. It needs to be in a more prominent place.
Well, I wouldn't want anyone in Louisiana to think I was a Texas nationalist.
Well, you know, people are afraid that we're everywhere already, you know, so it would be the first one flying outside the borders of Texas, though.
Now, I started something that is kind of, and I haven't put very much time into it lately, I confess, I should. And it was kind of based loosely on your model, but we call it, and there's a Facebook page out there. I never update it. And it's called the Louisiana Independence Party for much the same reasons why you started the Texas Nationalist Movement. So I have a couple of questions for you. Some of them may be tough, but you're up for the task. I know that. The first one is, if Texas were an independent country, a sovereign entity, you think that you would have been bombing Syria last weekend?
That's not a tough question. You know, I think, you know, when you look at this whole issue with Syria, strangely enough, I'm gonna tie this back to this last election. You know, there were right after Trump got elected, there was this idea somehow that this idea of Texas independence would sort of fizzle, right? This idea somehow that Texas and the drive for it was an itch that Trump would scratch. And what we told everyone was that's not the case. I mean, we surveyed our people. You know, we know where they stand. But you had to, you had to acknowledge that there were a certain portion of people out there that were willing to give the federal government or fixing the federal government another crack, right? They thought, okay, look, we'll throw a rattlesnake into the tent. You know, maybe that'll shake things up. And so, and I can tell you what I've seen since the Syria bombing is a lot of those people that sort of went back into that neutral position on the issue of Texas independence are on fire. I mean, you know, our memberships have been rolling in. Our support pledges have been up. We've had all kinds of folks that are contacting us via email, telephone, telling us, okay, look, this was it. You guys were right. So, you know, in independent Texas, and if you look at it from the way that most Texans view things, Texans by and large have not been supportive of these actions that have really kind of gone outside the bounds of the Constitution. Look, Texans want to be friends with people. We want to trade with people, you know, but the general sentiment is that we should not be involved in all of this foreign nonsense. I mean, what is the price and what is the purpose?
Yeah, I would love to say that the people of Louisiana were of similar opinion, but war fever getting the better of too many MAGA supporters these days. I'm seeing pretty much the opposite of that now.
Let me say this though before we move on to something else.
Sure.
The challenge here is that this issue, whether it's the Syria issue or so many issues, have not been properly placed to people. I mean, you have to look at it from the standpoint that a lot of the people that are jumping on this, you know, war fever bandwagon are doing so with some confirmation bias, right? They're looking at this to justify a decision that they made back in 2016 during the election. And so, you know, this is a lot of the challenge that we have. But you take that issue out of it. You know, let's get this thing down to a real deal debate about the direction of the federal government, the relationship between the states, how we are used and abused by a federal bureaucracy that does not know us, that does not care about us, that does not understand us. And all of a sudden now it's a different ballgame.
Yeah, I still find a lot of opposition out there for just if you use the S word, the term secession. If you blurt the S word out, this is where the dividing line, this is where people start quoting international law and it's illegal. And would you write it? Do you really want to do this and that? Or do you really want to leave the union? Are you sure that the Constitution allows this and all these legal questions? But before you and I talk about any of those, and we can, I think now my view of these of leaving the union and of independent sovereign states is it has evolved just a little bit. So this is really the tough question that I have for you, Daniel Miller, the Texas Nationalist Movement. What would you say to someone like me that says, "Well, you know, I'm all for redefining and maybe reorganizing our political affiliations and structures so that they look much more like they looked when they were ratified back in the 1790s. But I fear, though, that because we have so poor of a moral foundation and so poor, quite frankly, of a religious foundation to support that moral foundation, that even if Texas secedes or Louisiana secedes and is successful in it, you're just going to have a smaller group of the same moral outrages and atrocities, and it could devolve into just another never-ending revolution. Talk me down off the ledge."
Yeah, you know, I think it's interesting because that line of thought presupposes that somehow that we are better served, you know, whether it be strengthening of our moral foundation or mitigating the consequences of having a poor moral foundation, mm-hmm. that somehow that is served by being part of a political and economic union, which strips us of our right of self-government.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think we have to look at it. We have to look at it from a practical standpoint. Number one is your entire contention is that if we were to somehow roll this thing back,
mm-hmm.
To where the union was back in 1790. Well, that's a big if. You know, but honestly, from a Texas perspective, and frankly from any other state,
mm-hmm.
we're not in 1790, and the odds of putting the federal genie back in the bottle are, you know, honestly, it's a lot easier for us just to leave and govern ourselves than it is to try to convince people in other states, not to mention the federal bureaucracy, to jump back in that bottle. So, you know, that's not really, I think, where this is headed. I don't think it's that practical, nor do I think that being part of this political and economic union serves us well from a moral standpoint. And I'll give you a great example.
Okay.
You know, one of the challenges that we have here in Texas and also other states, you know, have the same challenge is that we are vehemently anti-abortion.
Yep.
Texas has some of the strongest anti-abortion restrictions. However, it is the federal courts that continue to shove Roe v. Wade down our throats. And so, you know, one of the things that I tell people often is, look, if you are a pro-life Texan, and you say that you're willing to do anything that you can to protect the sanctity of life, but yet you are unwilling to entertain Texas leaving the union, then you really aren't pro-life, right? Because you have elevated this political and economic union over this sincerely held moral belief, this right to life. So, you know, this is the kind of thing that we're out there talking to people about it. Mike, let me just flip this around, because I actually talk about this in the book.
Okay.
Because I think this gets back to some of the difficulty that you have You know, when you throw the S word down on the table, one of the things that we have done is we are sick and tired of playing defense to these ridiculous arguments that come from the opposition. You know, we have SmackDown. We love to call them Project Fear, you know, based on what they did during the Scottish referendum and during the Brexit debate. But that's what it is. It's a lot of fear-mongering. But what we've done is we've started turning the tables, and we started asking people out there, and we say, look, if Texas were an independent nation right now, mm-hmm. knowing what you know about the federal government, would you vote to enter the union? And all of a sudden the debate shifts, and now we can have some real conversations about, the selling points of the union, you know, the $21 trillion worth of debt. I mean, that's a real good selling point, right?
Well, there are a lot of good selling points. Daniel Miller is the founder of the Texas Nationalist Movement. The book is Texit, and the website is TexasNationalist.com. And Daniel and I have been affiliates and brothers in arms for quite a long time on this issue of independence and the sovereignty of the states here. I'm going to try one more small angle here on this, and then we'll move on. Here's my fear. This is where my thinking on this has evolved. My fear is not that we can practice self-government, and I don't think that we can ever put the genie back in the bottle. My fear is that when states secede and leave the union, because I think that they will, my fear is that one of the errors that was made in the constitutional order was believing that people can govern themselves and don't have any authority outside of themselves that they turn to for the differences between right and wrong. When you proclaim we the people, well, then you proclaim that man is the source of all law, but man's not. God is. There are a lot of God-fearing people in Texas. So in order to write these ships, the first thing we have to do is admit that, yes, we can practice self-government, but we have to have a law that is higher than our government's law. And if we do that, then we have the authority correct. And then that's a totally different set of circumstances. So that's my hang-up about it. And if you don't have an acknowledgement of some higher authority, well, then these things could just devolve into never-ending revolutions. So that's my fear.
And I can understand why it would be a legitimate fear for someone. You know, it was a legitimate fear back in the day when Texas declared its independence from Mexico.
Right.
You find it in the Texas Declaration of Independence, where there was essentially an indictment of the people of the other Mexican states. That exact line is, "We have come, therefore, to the melancholy conclusion that the Mexican people are incapable of self-government and unfit to be free." That is a line from our Declaration of Independence that I wrestled with for a long time.
Okay.
Because it tenders the idea that somehow there is a condition that exists where a people are not fit for freedom, right? That they just, you know, they somehow, you know, whether it's their moral fiber, their character, whatever it is, something has broken down to the point that they do not deserve self-government. So it was obviously a concern for the people of that day and age. I think it's a concern for us of this day and age. But I tender this to you, and that is, are we better served strengthening that moral fiber within the context of a federal political and economic union that shoves its morality down our throat through that mechanism? And I don't think that the case can be made that we will be able to within the confines of our own state be able to address those issues within the context of the federal union. I just don't think that case can be made. As long as we are outnumbered through that system by people that do not share our beliefs and our values, and can utilize that system at any time they want to impose their will upon us, then, you know, we've got some serious challenges.
844-527-8723 is our telephone number. Daniel Miller is the founder of the Texas Nationalist Movement and is my guest here on the Dude Maker Hotline here. Our website's at mikechurch.com. You can join our live chat there. If you have a question for Daniel, I'll be happy to pass it on to him. Just send it along. Go to mikechurch.com, click Mike Church Show live chat, or you can put it up on the Twitter feed. My Twitter address is at the King Dude, and Daniel's is at the Texian DM. let's go back to political talk here for a moment, Daniel. What's the mechanism? Is it a ballot initiative? Is it just a resolution? Because I know that there have been a couple of attempts inside the biannual meeting of the Texas legislature to draft some kind of articles of secession. What do you see as the mechanism? How do you see Texas getting out of, not that you need an excuse. Now, you and I come from the same place on this. There's no prohibition in the Constitution of a state leaving it. If you can ratify a constitution and join a union, then you ought to be able to nullify your contract, basically, and leave, voluntarily leave a political union. But there's an awful lot. Texas, what, 40 million people? How many people?
No, not quite. We're pushing on. They're estimating next census to be about 30 million.
Okay, 30 million people. Harris County, if you were to just count the economy of Harris County, would be like the 30th largest economy on the face of the earth. So there are two other cities, Dallas-Fort Worth and San Antonio, that are huge economies in there. Obviously, the federal magistrate is not going to want to let that tax base go. So how do you see in the book Texit, how does Texas get out of the federal union?
Look, it's pretty straightforward.
Okay.
Like, you know, you and I have had this conversation before, but it's amazing to me how few people understand how this would work, which is why I went through the entire process in the book, because frankly, I just got tired of talking about it all the time and having to explain it to people. But, you know, here's the thing. You and I, like you said, we're both on the same page here. There is no prohibition. So, you know, when we talk about that from a legal standpoint, both constitutional and international law, we're on solid footing. So we have to talk about really what the process is here in Texas. And it's pretty straightforward. Article 1, Section 2 of the Texas Constitution reserves the right to reform, alter, or abolish our form of government. And it says, in any manner we think expedient. So for us, that means that we have to utilize the first stop on the legality train here is we have to use existing structures and forms within the state government. So whether it's constitution, statute, whatever. So what that means for us is that we're going to have a referendum, because it is a political question that must be put to the people. Now, then the question becomes, how do we get that referendum? Well, Texas doesn't have initiative or true referendum here in Texas.
Okay.
Nothing citizen initiated, right? So what that means is that we have to get legislation passed through the Texas legislature to authorize this issue. Now, the good news about this is that there's already legislation that's been drafted. The last two sessions, we came closer than ever before to actually getting the legislation introduced. And in the last session, we were shopping around what I think is perhaps the most well-constructed piece of legislation ever on this issue that's ever been, that's been introduced or given to the Texas legislature. So I suspect that as we move into the next legislative session, which will start in January, that we're going to continue to build on that success, and we're going to see how it plays out.
It's the Mike Church Show here on the Crusade Channel at crusadechannel.com here on a Monday. We are live with Daniel Miller, the founder of the Texas Nationalist Movement. Now, let's just pretend for a moment that the ballot initiative or that particular legality actually gets prepared by or finally makes it to a vote. Now, the last time this came up, and there was a serious opportunity for this to actually maybe even make it to the next level, which would be for the governor to sign it. I think Rick Perry was governor at the time. It made it all the way to, like, the final hurdle. It was in the last committee that it needed to get out of, and as is usually the case, it was sabotaged or torpedoed or somebody bailed on the idea to go ahead and pass it and let the entire Texas Assembly vote on it and send it to Rick Perry, who was kind of rambling on about secession those days. So let's just pretend for a moment that the legal part of it actually happens. I seem to recall that one of the, in the earliest days of Texas's independence, if you will, that there was an agreement that was made somewhere in 1843 or 1844 or so, that Texas, if it ever became independent again, would reserve the right to, I believe there are six separate states inside or sovereign entities inside of Texas. I think there's there's two in the southeast, there's one in the north, there's one in the west, and there's one in the middle. Is that any part of the consideration, and do you write about that in the book?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I touch on what's going to be known as the five-state solution.
That's what it is. Okay.
That's actually a topic that I think almost deserves its own book. Because here's essentially what happened. When Texas came into the Union, It was annexed by a joint resolution of Congress, which there's obviously some question about the legality of annexing a state by a joint resolution of Congress.
Yep.
Since you have essentially two political sovereign political entities, should have been done by treaty. But what most people don't realize is that Texas was not admitted into the Union by treaty. The treaty was submitted to the United States Senate. The United States Senate voted it down. So you know you've got a challenge there. But as part of the joint resolution of annexation, one of the provisions was that Texas was granted a special right to essentially divide itself into four additional states. And the way that the verbiage is that those states would be granted admission.
Okay.
Which the verbiage in and of itself is interesting, since the fact that it says that Texas could create four additional states and that those states would be granted admission. Doesn't mean that it doesn't say that they're automatically granted admission, but it essentially implies by the verbiage that those four additional states would have the option to enter the Union if they so choose. So, you know, there's a lot of interesting irregularities because there was no severability clause in the joint resolution, and the fact that Texas was granted special provisions means that, and because they're, you know, states when they come in are supposed to come in on equal footing under the equal footing doctrine. There are some actual interesting arguments that you could follow that because there's no severability in the joint resolution in the agreement, and it's the five state solution is essentially a violation of the equal footing doctrine. Then it renders the entire annexation null and void. So there are some interesting arguments that could be made from a legal standpoint, but we have to talk about it from practical terms.
Right,
and
right.
Practical terms mean that we need to take this to a vote.
Yeah, and Article 4 of the Constitution is actually the clause that deals with admitting new states. Now, it's always been interesting to me, you probably, all of you listening out there to the Mike Church Show here, and my special guest Daniel Miller of the Texas Nationalist Movement, You've all heard of the worst Supreme Court decision in the history of Supreme Court decisions, the Dred Scott decision, and what a xenophobic, racist bigot Justice Taney was, and this and that and the other. Well, before you go and you sign off on that and say, okay, yeah, he was, and you just repeat what you've heard, do yourself a favor and go read the Dred Scott decision. Because while there is an admission in there that the three-fifths clause is still in effect and is still legal, and sans an amendment, that's exactly what you should say if you don't want Supreme Court justices writing laws Justice Taney also said, and this is where it's important, and this came up in the Clive and Bundy case and all that stuff, that was, those shenanigans that were going on out there during the first years of the Obama administration, 2011 and 12. Justice Taney actually says, look, Congress, the framers of the Constitution were explicitly referring to the Northwest Territory when they wrote the Territory Clause. That we're explicitly referring to the Northwest Territory, which would mean, where's your constitutional permission, or where's your hall pass, if you will, for the U.S. to have to claim that it owned Nevada, Montana, Wyoming, parts are outside the Northwest Territory, Utah, I'm trying to think of what else was in it, whatever those countries were. So there was a very flimsy legal basis for much of what happened when Congress decided that they were going to start owning lands, and then they were going to assert that they had the authority to do so. And what Daniel was saying was, well, you know, Texas's case is kind of outside of that. It wasn't a territory. It was never presented, and no one ever thought of it as a territory. Instead, it was thought of as a part of Mexico, and then of course there was a secession there, or a split of that affiliate of that alliance there. I mean, basically, Texas joined the Union out of convenience. It was good for the Union because it gave passageway from Louisiana to then Arizona and then New Mexico and, of course, California. So for the Union, it makes sense. But it was Texas's choice. You guys did not have to join the Union, did you?
No, it's actually interesting. The sentiment here in Texas was divided for quite some time. But the sentiment against Texas joining the Union was extraordinarily high in the United States at the time. As a matter of fact, Abraham Lincoln, when he was a congressman, stood on the floor of Congress and argued against the annexation of Texas. But it really has. There's a lot of obviously a lot of interesting history, and I mean that's wonderful. But the fact of the matter is that really serves to inform us more about what the true nature of the relationship is between not just Texas and the Union, but really all states in the Union.
Right, right.
It's interesting to note that Texas was not a province of Mexico. It was a state of the United States of Mexico. And most people don't realize that's actually what Mexico is still called to this day, is the United States of Mexico.
Oh, I talk about Texas it all the time.
Yeah, I mean, Texas left a federal union because of the usurpation of its constitutional rights and the liberties of its citizens to, you know, whether it was the right to keep and bear arms or even just the right to draw a breath, Texas made the decision to leave. And, you know, were it not for, and again, these unusual turns of history, were it not for the fact that the propaganda machine ramped up inside the United States and basically scared everyone into thinking that Texas would be a foothold for Great Britain if it was not admitted into the Union, then things might be a little bit different. We wouldn't be having this conversation about Texas leaving the Union right now. Of course, it didn't hurt that Sam Houston sent a map to him and said, look, if you guys don't agree to letting Texas in the Union, here's what Texas will look like. And he drew the map all the way to the Pacific Ocean. So I'm sure that didn't hurt the cause at all.
Yeah, I'm sure it didn't. Daniel Miller is the founder of the Texas Nationalist Movement. The book is Texit. Now, before Texit, your first book was called Line in the Sand. Now, that
right.
was a story of independence, I guess, right?
No, it actually, you know, if you're comparing the two books, I wrote Line in the Sand to deal with sort of the core philosophy of Texas nationalism.
Okay.
Back in 2011, there were a lot of folks that just didn't understand what Texas nationalism was. I mean, they didn't understand this idea that Texas is a nation and what nationalism is in sort of the context of global geopolitics. So It was sort of the philosophy about Texas nationalism, just helping people understand, look, here's what a nation is. You know, here's what a state is. Therefore, here's what a nation state is, and here's how Texas fits that bill. So if Line in the Sand is a book really about philosophy and about Texas nationalism, then Texan is a book really about motivations and process.
Okay.
It's very detailed, dealing with the process, not just of how we got to this point, but how we move on to actually gaining our independence and a look ahead at what that could look like moving forward.
Do you hear in conversations that you have with people that are reticent about Texas leaving the Union for some of the reasons that many of the propagandists in Great Britain tried to convince people that they should be reticent about leaving the European Union? Do you hear some of the same tactics that, well, you won't have a currency, Louisiana will refuse to trade with Texas, we'll be surrounded, we're landlocked, except for a little sliver, except for the coastline of the Gulf of Mexico, et cetera, et cetera. How do you address the how do you address the concern that you'll be isolated and economically made poor, if you will?
Well, just to give you an idea of how much I see the similarities, I literally have a chapter in the book called Project Fear, which deals with all of that. You know, it really is. Look, some of the most ridiculous opposition arguments that you could imagine, I have heard. It's surprising that I have not heard, the argument that, well, Texas leaves the Union, what if an asteroid hits? I mean, that's the kind of realm of ridiculous uncertainty. But what I do in the book, Mike, is I take all of these issues, whether it be trade, travel, whether it be the people that have accumulated federal benefits. I take all of those issues, and what I do is I don't generate any new information. What I show is how it actually already works in the world,
mm-hmm.
what United States federal policy is, and what I do is I extrapolate from that and say, look, this is how it's done right now. So if you wanted an analog
mm-hmm.
post-independence that minimized disruption, this is how you would handle it. People talk about trade and travel is one of the ones people are concerned with. I'm like, why do you want to go to Oklahoma? They're like, well, it is the largest county in Texas, so we would like to be able to travel it. I actually deal with that, and I go, look, you guys realize that, almost every year you've got millions of people that travel between Mexico and Texas and the other border states with nothing more than a border transit card. I mean, they don't have to apply for a tourist visa. They don't have to go through all this paperwork.
Nope.
All they have to do is apply for this card and they travel. And so there's I think the stat was almost a million border crossings every single day between Mexico and the border states that are affected by this border transit card. I look at, the issue of trade. Look, how are we going to do business with the United States? I mean, people say this. It's first and foremost, they're going to want to do business with Texas because, 90% of the exports that we have here in Texas are the technology exports, and so it's not just oil and gas. But beyond that, I show, look, you're already effectively in an economic union of sorts with every country that the United States federal government has executed a free trade agreement with. So when you do business with someone in Oklahoma or Louisiana or one of these other states, it is effectively like you're doing business with South Korea or Jordan or any of the 22-plus other nations that the United States has a free trade agreement with. There is essentially no difference from an economic and trade standpoint between a state of the union and some of these countries that the United States has executed a free trade agreement with. So I go through all of that because, I get tired of hearing it, Mike.
Now,
being honest.
Fascinating to me that you got Nigel Farage to write the foreword to the book Texas. Now, for those of you who don't know,
Nigel didn't write the foreword. That was a mock-up of the cover that someone did.
Oh, okay. Was he going to?
There were discussions and some conversations, but as you might imagine, the relationship that he has with the occupant at Pennsylvania Avenue put the kibosh on that. So,
well,
it was disappointing. I was disappointed. Well, but
how interesting that the kibosh was put on Brexit from teaming up with Texit. Now. Now, there are some serious similarities here, and some things that you could take away from what happened in the UK when the UKIP started in 1988, the United Kingdom Independence Party. There were three members, but there was one MP, Farage. That was it. When Brexit finally got to the polls and it ultimately it passed via referendum, basically the UKIP was a force to be reckoned with inside of the UK. Now, what would be kind of tempering Texas independence from the United States would be that you now have the story, and you could see how the Brexit has played out. To my knowledge, the United Kingdom is still in the European Union, and now the will of the people has been thwarted. The will of people that voted basically has been thwarted by the elite ruling masters in Parliament. They're not going to let them leave. So, you have any fear of that? You write about that in the book. Even if the people of Texas said, "Yeah, we want in, we want out," that the legislature, the government of Texas would say, "Yeah, not so fast. We're going to have to think about this."
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. A lot of that, from our perspective, depends on the legislation that enables the referendum.
Okay.
and how tough that is. And actually, in the book, I include proposed referendum language and some things that Texans need to, you know, that support Texas need to look out for. But look, I want to go to your other point,
sure,
which is this idea, these analogs between us and Brexit. Look, we draw information and inspiration from all of these referenda around the world, you know, whether it be the UK referendum or whether it was the Scottish referendum in 2014 or what went down in Catalonia, and I write about that a little bit because, you know, we had to get the print. So there were, you know, some developments after that. But, you know, to your point about Brexit, because I think it has served as a very strong model of instruction and information for us. Number one is, regardless of what the ruling elites do in the UK, the fact of the matter is that the clock is ticking. Once they invoke the Article 50, they've got a two-year clock on that thing, and whatever the deal is that gets hammered out is what gets hammered out if there's an extension. But I will say this. Given the number of people that supported Brexit, mm-hmm. which polling numbers show that the number of people who supported is higher now than it was before the referendum, particularly because of the very poor treatment that the UK has gotten at the hands of the bureaucrats in Brussels. If Theresa May and the Conservative Party do not deliver a true Brexit, what you're going to see is that not the previous general election result, but the one before that, where UKIP came in essentially the third place as far as voting goes, knocking the Lib Dems out of the boat. You're going to see a seismic shift to UKIP voters, because at that moment, the voters of the UK will know and they will understand that the only party that will deliver a true Brexit that the voters said that they wanted will be the UK Independence Party.
Right.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to, and I think that's a very likely possibility. although they are bound to have to act upon the referendum. Otherwise, what's the point in having a referendum? And the history of the people of the UK in not getting their political way when they've been told that they're going to get something is not a pretty one. So Theresa May want to act upon that. Daniel, we're just about out of time. Final question. How large is the Texas nationalist movement? And is it larger? Are there other? I know in Vermont you have the Vermont Independence Project, and there are people that want Vermont to leave the state but aren't members of the Vermont Independence Project. I know in Alaska there's the Alaska Independence Party, and there are people that think that Alaska should leave the union as well, and that to me is a no-brainer if they weren't being bribed with all the federal dollars that go back there. But they're not members of the Alaska Independence Party or the Alaska Independence Movement. So how big in terms of numbers would you put the Texas nationalist movement and the push for Texas independence?
Well, it's a great question, and so I think we have to look at it two ways. First off, look at the Texas Nationalist Movement.
Okay,
registered supporters are currently over 377,000.
Okay,
so if you put that in the context of other political and advocacy organizations, we had a study that was someone else did that was sent to us. It was almost about a year and a half ago now. And essentially what it did was it compared the TNM's numbers to other advocacy organizations as a percentage per capita of registered voters in the area that they serve. So a good example would be, it compared us to the NRA was one of them. And said, okay, look, what the number of declared supporters for the NRA in Texas, their membership numbers is X. And what is that percentage of registered voters? Because, we get slurred all the time. When people see 377,000, they're like, well, there'll be 25, 26, 27 million people in Texas. That's a very small percentage. So, you want to compare apples to apples. And what it came out to be was that Texas was the second largest political advocacy organization by that stat in Texas, second only to the NRA.
Okay.
You look at it in the context of independence organizations, we're the second largest in the Western Hemisphere, second only to the PQ in Quebec.
Okay.
So that makes us not just second in the Western Hemisphere, but one of the largest in the world. So that's really, to me, impressive. But what you have to get down to is not just those people that are declared supporters, that have filled out a form that said, look, I support it, I'll vote for it. You got to look at what the electorate wants. And what we have seen time and time again since they really started earnestly polling this issue back in 2009, plus the internal polls that we have done as an organization, is we've seen an upward growth trajectory. We've seen well over a majority of Republican voters here in Texas say that they want Texas to leave the union. We've seen at or over a majority of independent voters say the same thing, and even in excess of one-third of Texas Democrats say that they want Texas to leave the union. So, when you overlay those numbers based on how Texans vote, what you get is right now you've got about 12, anywhere, depending on the polling, between 12 to 16% of Texans that are undecided on the issue, and you've got the people that support Texas leaving the union anywhere from 4 to 6, and sometimes as much as 8 points ahead of those that are convinced that they want to stay. But all of that's just polling. Until we have a vote on the issue and a real debate leading up to a binding vote, we're not going to know how anyone stands. And so I think we're more well-positioned than we have ever been to be able to debate this issue, to have a vote on this issue, and let the chips fall where they may. We can make our case. The opposition cannot. And we're willing to take this all the way to a vote to prove that point.
Yeah, and you've got the recent, very sensible, very well thought out bill that came out of the Texas legislature that was signed, I think it was signed by Rick Perry, not Abbott, but I may be wrong, where Texas basically said, look, we're a sovereign entity. We have our own medical boards here. And you do not have faculties to go and kill babies at a hospital in Texas unless you have faculty or at a clinic in Texas, unless you have faculties, practicing faculties, medical practicing faculties, credentials, if you will, at a hospital. And of course, it was sensible. It made sense. And the federales came in and said, yeah, we're not going to let that law stand. It'll be fresh in people's minds. And you're right. Second, right next to Louisiana, you guys are as pro-life as any other state is out there. Well, Daniel, it's great to get an update on all this. Where do folks go to find out more? Many Texans listening right now that may want to join the TNM or contact you about it.
Sure. You can find out more about the organization at TexasNationalist.com. And then, of course, April 21st, San Jacinto Day, the new book, Texit, Why and How Texas Will Leave the Union, drops. It's available for pre-order right now at Amazon, at Barnes & Noble, and it'll be available in all major book retailers starting April 21st.
And that comes out on San Jacinto Day. You said April 21st?
April 21st.
April 21st.
We're 5 days away.
Well, congratulations on the book. It's good to hear from you. I want to keep tabs on this and keep talking about it. So we'll have you back soon, as soon as there's something new to report. Thanks for your time, Daniel. Always a pleasure, brother.
Thanks, Mike. It's great to talk to you again.
Yes, sir. We'll talk soon.